Thank you. And thanks for letting me jump in the middle. So one of the advantages of hanging out at liberal arts college is that you learn the MLA style of writing talks titles, right? All the linguists and the humanists do this interesting first bit and then colon, and then they explain what the hell they're doing. So this is one of their tricks. This is a talk that actually I wrote for, I gave to my colleagues at Carleton, and by colleagues, I mean all the scientists. So it's a very soft talk. And so press me to deepen it whenever you'd like to hear more than I have. Okay, so just to, this is something I said earlier, but my research is about as far as I can get from introductory physics, where everything is classical and linear. This is nonlinear dynamics, and it's, I work somewhat in the intersection of nonlinear dynamics and quantum mechanics, which sort of falls into stat-mech in the long run, if you look at it the right way and squint. But saying nonlinear dynamics doesn't mean much, of course, because that's like saying you work in non-elephant biology, as the old joke goes, because there's only one linear system and everything else is nonlinear. So I'm really interested in some specific questions, and these things are getting larger because really these two things dominate my life. Things we don't know anything about. By we, I mean no one knows anything about. What is the statistical behavior of a truly nonlinear dynamical system when it's far from equilibrium? In fact, it's something, one of Jerry Golub's experiments with persistent patterns is something I've been struggling with for years to try to understand. And so sometimes our work is completely classical, and that's the stuff to look at. But more of my work is just trying to understand quantum dynamics when the underlying classical dynamics is chaotic or complicated. And the focus of today's talk is really how do we get from quantum to classical systems? How do we make the transition? And I'll talk about that in a second, what I mean by that. Okay, so today's talk is going to start off with two quick reminders, and they'll be particularly quick for this audience, but what it means to be quantum and what the difference between quantum and classical dynamics is, and about chaos. Then I'll introduce, really more in the sense of leaving it on the screen and talking about it until you're satisfied that let me proceed, about quantum trajectories. And then I'll show you two results in using quantum trajectories. One where you recover classical chaos from the appropriate limit. This is sort of a standard result. And then the real novel result of this particular piece of research, which is that you can induce chaos quantum mechanically. And that is considered to be not possible. So it's more to the point, it shows that going from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics need not be monotonic, which is, in some sense, the deepest lesson of this particular bit of research. Okay, and please stop me as often as you would like. Okay, quantum non-classical behavior. Again, please remember this was written for biologists in some way. So this is something all of us know. Quantum mechanics is not classical. Explicitly, quantum mechanics, at least the simplest way you can say it exists as wave functions, which means that you get probabilities plus interference between two. If you have the superposition of waves, you get not just the sum of the probabilities, but you also get interference between the two waves. And I won't bother showing you pictures of interference in tunneling. Would you like to see one? Okay, let's see if this works. What this is a link to a website that has pretty pictures of interference in tunneling. So we'll see if we get there. Interference. And a very nice picture. So let's pick one, doesn't even matter. There we go. And it's from Netherlands. I'm happy to send you a link. I have no idea. I just found a nice picture. So you can say that even sending a single, it's a QuickTime movie. Yeah. No, this one is NL.
Yeah,
so.
NL, Netherlands.
Okay, right. Okay, yeah. So here we go. So you can see interference effects, just that a particle can behave like a wave and has patterns which are visible staring out over that cliff right there, you know, that you have probability that behaves that way. All right, that I'm sure we've seen many times. But you can also get tunneling effects. Oh, did I already do this? Same page. Let's look at some tunneling. Where, let's see. So at that time there was a hole in the barrier and the particle trying to get through, got all ripply trying to get through. And now we actually squeeze that hole off. So there's no hole in the barrier, and yet the particle will get through if you wait long enough, or if you have the right kind of system that you're looking at. It goes, and a little bit goes through, and then because it's hard boundary conditions, it reflects back. Okay. So this is just two very simple non-classical behavior that you can see in a quantum particle. Just a reminder from, as Steve Weinberg used to say, as you learned in kindergarten, quantum particles can do these kind of things. Okay. Though, of course, as we've recently discovered from the world of quantum information theory, these things are not that non-classical in that classical waves can do these things. What is truly disconcertingly non-classical is entanglement. That there's no classical counterpart whatsoever, but I will not talk about that. I mean, disturbing as interference and tunneling is for a particle, it is not what causes you to tear your hair out ultimately about how unbelievably bizarre the world of quantum mechanics is. It's entanglement that's supposed to be considered. So there's a lot more about quantum mechanics than just the properties I'm focusing on, but it doesn't matter. Okay. This last one may not be kindergarten knowledge for most of us, but it doesn't take too much thinking about it. There's no property of Schrodinger's equation that can be chaotic. Now, I'll define chaos in a second, but there's no property of Schrodinger's equation for a single particle that can be anything other than periodic, because you've got a linear equation with a discrete spectrum, provided it's a closed system. I'm talking about closed systems right now. Let's not open it up. And that's, so it's a linear equation with a discrete spectrum. So it's got bunches of oscillating objects. And so ultimately, anything that is represented as the expectation value of all these wave functions has to be quasi-periodic at best. That means it's, at best, a sum of many, many periods. Okay? And chaos is explicitly requires that you have to go beyond quasi-periodicity, so you are bounded aperiodic motion. Okay, chaotic. So it's, in one line, this is the whole problem of quantum chaos, that you have chaos existing classically but not quantum mechanically, and how do you manage to make that transition? Okay. And it leads to all sorts of paradoxes, which I will not belabor right now, but basically what it comes down to is that the following. Now, even though I said that we're talking about the quantum mechanics of the underlying classical problem, really it's the other way around. The world is fundamentally quantum. And classical reality must emerge from quantum properties. You don't go from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics. Classical mechanics must emerge from quantum mechanics in some way. It's not the other way around. And these, in fact, are being probed on a regular basis in cold atom experiments, so in nanomechanical oscillators of various kinds. I don't know if you know about these claims of vibrating oscillators which show evidence for quantized displacement. They're more likely to be found in certain discrete steps rather than others. Little vibrating mechanical oscillators, pretty amazing thing. Okay. So we have all these really cool, literally cool experiments going on, and we're trying to figure out where exactly is that boundary between behaving weirdly and not behaving weirdly. Okay. So the transition is not simple at all. And in particular, it's clearly singular in some way. In some mysterious way, it's a singular transition, because how can you go from non-chaos to chaos smoothly? That doesn't happen. That doesn't make sense. It's a singular limit. Okay? And the usual statement of the H bar to zero limit of quantum mechanics is non-trivial. I mean, it's not a trivial statement at all. And when I say something is singular, the quantum chaos community says this as the limits of time going to infinity and h bar going to zero are not interchangeable. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about it. And when I say h bar going to zero, of course, we mean h bar divided by the characteristic action of the system under consideration. Okay, and the solution to the paradox is not that huge or surprise anymore. 15 years ago, Wojciech Zurek's article in Physics Today created some controversy, but nowadays I think maybe the other way around. Someone said that he didn't need to consider the effect of the environment to understand how you get from classical to quantum mechanics, people would be surprised. It's fairly well accepted now that you need to include the effect of the environment when thinking about quantum mechanical systems. And what we mean by the environment is really whatever system you got, the rest of the universe. Okay, that's what we mean by the environment. Everything that the particle is interacting with, which is not taken care of by the system's Hamiltonian. The description is not taken care of. Like this. Okay, so that's a starting point for the theoretical work. And let me rephrase this in more formal language, perhaps. Basically, what I'm thinking about is how does Schrodinger go to Newton or Hamiltonian, or how does Hilbert space go to phase space? And the following is stolen pretty much directly from something Wojciech once said, which is this is not a simple formal thing. If you think about it for a second, space is, well, huge. And as my cosmologist friends keep reassuring me, it's hard to grasp. Okay. Anyone in dynamical systems will tell you that phase space is, well, larger. But Hilbert space is exponentially larger than anything you can wrap your head around in phase space. Okay. So Hilbert space is exponentially larger than phase space, and phase space is larger than space. So here's the quote that I'd like to give you. However much your mind boggles about when thinking about space, you have to, you know, exponentiate that boggling to think about Hilbert space. And then the beauty of this is that this was not fully appreciated or attacked till 15 years ago. I mean, the whole quantum information theory game is like, whoa, look at that. There's so much phase space, well, no, Hilbert space to explore, and people are diving into it and having a blast, basically, trying to figure out how to navigate in this space, let alone exploit. Okay. And this is the, in principle, funding spiel, if I actually, despite what I said earlier. Okay, right, that was off the record. Yeah, now the microphone's on. So this is why it's so critical to understand this, because it's important to quantum control, quantum information, quantum computing, and basically to the foundation of the quantum mechanics itself. You have to understand how this transition happens, otherwise you don't know when you're being quantum mechanical. You can claim something is quantum mechanical, but if you can reproduce it with Hamilton's equations, you're not. Okay, so you have to understand what the distinction is. All right, having said all that about quantum mechanics, let me tell you some useful things to know about chaos, which I presume by now, again, has bled into the world. Even if you're not a specialist in chaos, you know this, but I'll remind you. Chaos requires that that if you take two trajectories, you're solving for two trajectories in phase space, that they exponentially deviate. Okay, this is synonymous in a way that's fairly complicated, not easy for me to fully grasp, let alone explain. This is synonymous with the idea of aperiodic bounded motion. So if you're aperiodic and bounded, it also means that if you take two nearby trajectories, they will exponentially separate over the short run. In the long run, they contain the same space, so they will go near each other. But you have no idea where one of them is going to be if you make a mistake about it. The second useful thing to know about chaos is that the generic nonlinear dynamical system is chaotic. Okay, so pretty much anything you want to think about is chaotic, or some example of it is chaotic. And one of the most beautiful one of the earliest examples of this was the Lorentz butterfly. Okay. All right, fair enough. I won't show it to you. Oh, wait, actually, I can. I discovered something very cool on Macs recently. I'm trying to convert to being a Mac. It's really glass. Okay. This is the solution. There's an application called Grapher. Let me tell you what's going on. Okay, right. So this is a solution to three dynamical equations, which are written up there. Okay, only slightly nonlinear. Okay, there's three coupled dynamical equations, which are only slightly, as I say, nonlinear, and we are tracking the solution to these three coupled equations, okay, in the three-dimensional phase space. And the solutions happen to fall onto what is not a very vivid color, but a very beautiful pattern, which is a so-called Lorentz butterfly. Okay, this is the strange attractor in this three coupled equations. That is to say, all solutions will fall onto this. However, two solutions infinitesimally separated from each other will both fall onto this attractor, but at any given point in time, you have no idea where they are with respect to each other. So you know your solution's on the attractor, you just don't know where it is. Okay, so that immediately tells you that you should be thinking statistically when you think about chaos, basically, if nothing else. But also gives you, this is the butterfly to which I was referring. This is the Lorentz butterfly. It's the Lorentz attractor. Then he used the idea of a butterfly flapping its wings. So then that's a confused idea of what the Lorentz butterfly is. But OK, this is a solution to the differential equation. Does that answer your question, Peter? Yeah, good. All right. So that's an example of chaos. Whoa, sorry. Especially with Rolf getting impatient. Sorry about that. Okay, any questions so far? You get the Lorentz butterfly, and also if you, this is an attractor I want you to focus on slightly. It's a driven double well problem with dissipation. So there's two wells, there's a little bit of dissipation, and there's driving, where the wells are being rocked back and forth. And what I'm plotting is the location of one trajectory after every period of the driving. Okay, so it's a strobe plot, or a Poincaré section, and gives you this peculiar attractor in phase space.
Is the drive large enough to actually drive you over the barrier?
It's an attractor, so it doesn't matter what your initial energy is. And it's a dissipated problem. In the absence of the...
What I'm asking is, you're driving it, right? So you're taking this double well and you're going like this. Is the size of the driving force enough to actually make the barrier disappear?
This is a classical problem. So if it went across, it must be, right?
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. Well, I'm saying yes, absolutely.
It has inertia, so it could pick up energy and then go over without the barrier actually.
Right, but it's got dissipation as well, so it couldn't.
It depends.
No, it could do it once, and it could do it twice, but in the long run, the solution has to drop in one side or the other, without driving.
No, but I'm asking about the driving.
Okay. With the driving, all solutions cross back and forth. That's all I can tell you.
Okay.
Okay? With the driving, all solutions cross back and forth in precisely this pattern.
Okay.
Does that answer that question?
Sort of.
Okay. I mean, I think the notion of energy becomes complicated when you have dissipation and driving, which is why I'm answering it the way I am, which is that with the driving, no matter what your initial condition was, all solutions will converge to this particular solution where they are crossing back and forth, even in the presence of dissipation. No. If you crank up the dissipation enough, they'll drop to one side, but at this particular parameter value that I'm showing you. Okay.
Right,
periodic,
right?
Okay, I see. I'm sorry. I take this back. Now I understand. If it was sitting at the bottom of the well, would it cross the barrier? No.
Okay.
Okay. Is the driving large enough? With full dissipation, is the driving equal to the size of the barrier? No.
Okay.
That now I get what you're saying. Okay. But I see that as a dissipation effect. You know, that you got to crank up the dissipation infinitely high to land up at the bottom of the well. Okay. And just to show you there's not abstract ideas, this is a hydrogen atom which is being kicked by electric field, and this is the Poincaré section of the strobe plot you get for this, and it's chaotic. And this is a poor hydrogen atom in Barry Dunning's lab in Rice University, which is, you know, they say the biggest atoms in the world are in Texas. This is a hydrogen atom that's been stretched to about half a millimeter because it's n equals 500 and subjected to this behavior, so it's behaving completely classically. All right, so how would I talk about quantum mechanics in this context? I need to compare wave packets to classical trajectories, but I don't want to do that. What I'll do in the following is compare wave packets with the expectation values of Q and P. Okay. That's not necessarily the only way to do it. You should really compare probabilities with probabilities, and that's what I usually do, and I'm happy to discuss the distinctions between the two. But in the following, I'm going to look at this evolution of the expectation values of Q and P so that I have a sort of a phase space in quantum mechanics. And as I said, I've got to include the effect of the environment, and I'm starting to scroll fast. And the way I'm going to do it is with a formalism known as QSD, or quantum stochastic dynamics, or quantum state diffusion, which is the first term is just a Schrodinger equation, and then you have all this stuff that models the effect of the environment. And since Rolf is giving me the evil eye, did you account for the delay?
Absolutely.
All right. This is the equation you get. And I'm happy to talk about it in detail later. But there's one stochastic term. This is a noise term, which is Gaussian noise. But other than that, it's deterministic, but it's nonlinear because you've got the expectation value of this operator in the formalism. And this is called the Lindblad formalism for modeling open systems. But it captures, it's a complete model, as in you can show that all environmental behavior can be captured by the right choice of the Lindblad operator. So it's an inclusive model. It's like saying P squared plus Q plus V of Q. That is to say all Hamiltonian systems are captured by that model.
Actually,
it's not true. Okay. So, right, sorry. I was giving a bad example. You're right. Okay, sorry. But what this is supposed to be an inclusive statement for Markovian environments. Let me be clear about this. For Markovian environments. Yeah, it's a Markovian environment is the important part. Right. It could be X. It could be P. It could be X plus IP, which is what I use. Okay. And that gives you dissipation. So here's the Duffing problem that I'm going to study. And I'm now going to just state it to you. So this is the Duffing problem. And I'm going to quantize it. For quantization, I need to use all that. It's a driven double well problem I was telling you about, with that Lindblad operator, which is a Q plus IP Lindblad operator. And I have two parameters, which is damping and degree of quantumness. And you can show that the classical equations obtained from those equations are beta versus zero. And what are the transition details, which is what I'm focused on, really? There's two knobs. One is the damping, and the other is the quantumness of the problem. So beta really is sort of the size of H bar in this problem. Okay, I'm just going to show you this way of thinking about it, that approximately speaking, you should think of increasing h-bar as raising the zero-point energy and creating tunneling by slicing off the barrier difference. That keeps increasing until you're effectively in a single well as you increase beta. As you keep cranking up h-bar, you effectively land up in a single well. And you can show that pretty clearly. All right, and here are the results for so-called standard. You can show that for a certain dissipation, gamma equals 0.125, as you increase beta, you go from the chaotic attractor to what is really localized with a little bit of noise kind of behavior. This is a standard argument that you're going from classically chaotic behavior to quantum regular behavior with a little bit of noise in it. And you get noise spectra, power spectra, which verify your statement that you're going from chaos to a regular plus noise. So this is the standard argument. And you can look at the energy and position dynamics. And the cool thing is, in the classical limit, you only cross over when you have positive energy. You only cross from one barrier to another with positive energy. In the quantum regimes, which is intermediate beta and high beta, you can actually cross over even with negative energy, quote unquote. You can be under the barrier and still be crossing over, which is indicative of tunneling going on. Okay, so this is nice to know. Okay. Now what I'm showing you is the anomalous or the cool result. That is, if you damp the system enough, then at close to the classical limit, you just get behavior isolated entirely in one well, which is what that black line on the left there is. In intermediate regimes, you actually see the chaotic attractor emerge. And at high beta, again, you go back to classically regular behavior with a little bit of noise. Okay, and the power spectra confirms the statement that you have chaos in between and not at either limit. Classical or the quantum. In this case, the argument is straightforward. To be able to have chaos in a double well problem, you need to be able to transition between the two wells. And it's only the intermediate quantum regime that actually sees the two wells. The classical regime sits at the bottom. The extreme quantum regime doesn't see two wells, but the intermediate regime sees two wells and tunnels back and forth, apart from being driven back and forth and so on. Okay, in the interest of time, I will move and wait, I hope, for questions. The similar statements apply, that you can only cross from one well to another classically if you have positive energy. You don't actually cross at all in this problem. Whereas in the quantum In the intermediate problem, in the quantum problem, you can actually cross over with negative energy. All that's the box. There's some films you can see. Okay. I don't know what happened there. Well, maybe we can see the films later. But here's a summary, which is the critical part. Let's see if I can get the film again. Okay, here. Okay, so that's the classical problem. It's basically a point particle, which is on one side. The in between, you can see desperately trying to get through the barrier, and wiggling like crazy. It will, but it behaves very quantum mechanical while doing it. Whereas at high quantum levels, it's like barrier, what barrier? They're sitting out there going from side to side as it wants. Okay. And you can watch this. Well, you can see that it's tunneled through in that case after having struggled a bit. Okay. So that's the end of my talk if you let me put my summary up there, which is that classically chaotic dynamics can be recovered for open quantum systems. Even in this open system, there's no chaos in the deep quantum limit. Quantum chaos different from the classical limit exists. That is that there's tunneling, there's quantum chaos accompanied by tunneling. And finally, that you can have quantum-induced chaos. That is to say, chaos which doesn't exist in the classical problem can show up in the quantum problem. The deeper message, as I said, is that the quantum classical transition is not monotonic. So this is we're battling this at FISREV right now. Letters, we'll see. And there's a larger paper in preparation. There's other work that we can talk about, but I won't right now. The films were made by an undergraduate. I gave him some coefficients, and he said, okay, I'll create a wave function from that. And now he's creating Wigner functions from these coefficients. So that's what an undergraduate gets to do. Thank you very much. Yes. Yeah, sorry. Right. Okay, so beta is the size of the quartic term, okay? So if beta is small, then it descends very deep before it wraps back up as the quartic term. And so your size of H bar is quite small compared to the depth of the well, for instance, or the size of phase space that you can travel, okay? As beta gets larger, the well wraps back faster and faster. So the size of phase space that you cover is comparable to H bar. In this case, H bar is 1. I just said H bar to 1 in this problem. Okay. Does that make sense? So it's really the size of the quartic term. And also, to get the units right, you have to scale the driving with it. If you take the classical problem and change beta, it turns out you get exactly the same picture, just on different scales. So classically, beta makes no difference. And quantum mechanically, beta changes the problem completely because it defines the size of H bar. That's almost instantaneous.
That's comparable
to the point scale for tunneling. Yeah. So the damping happens in two ways. It happens as the center of the wave packet drops to the bottom, but also damping helps localize the wave packet. So the higher the damping compared to beta or whatever, then you can get more sharply localized wave packets as well. But it just happens. I mean, it's okay. It remains unitary.
Inside,
yes. If you want to recover rho, the density matrix, you just average over various. No, but I'm saying if you do, then you average over various realizations of the stochastic differential equation. Right. But I'm giving you the behavior of a single wave function, in principle realizable in the lab, because this is being affected by a single environmental interaction. Sure. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Daryl.